Imagine building a billion-dollar company from scratch, like
Sure.
right in your garage. You pour literally years of your life into it. You finally get it off the ground, the valuation skyrockets, and you are totally ready to cash out and buy a private island.
Yeah, the absolute dream, right?
Right. But then you find out that if you try to just log into a brokerage account and sell your own shares to the general public, you could actually be committing a federal crime and end up in prison.
Which is definitely a vibe killer for the island purchased.
Oh, totally. A
Right.
massive vibe killer. So today we are looking at the invisible and sometimes really terrifying roadblocks of equity ownership. But before we get into how you can be legally blocked from selling your very own property, this deep dive is actually brought to you by CertFuel.
Yep.
They've got a full series 66 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. It's awesome. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, so if you are listening to this right now, you are gearing up for the Series 66 exam. And our mission today is highly, highly specific. We want to completely dismantle the characteristics of equity securities.
Completely tear it down to the studs.
Exactly, because we know standard dry textbook lectures are just, they are the absolute enemy of actually retaining information, especially if your brain is anything like mine and you just totally tune out the second a monotone voice starts listing off like bullet points. So we are doing this differently.
Yeah, exactly. Because when you understand the underlying logic of the financial markets, you stop memorizing disjointed facts,
Right.
and you start seeing the actual matrix behind it all.
Right.
The goal here is that when you sit down for the exam, you can figure out the answer to a question you've never even seen before, purely because the underlying mechanics just like naturally make sense to you. You'll actually know why the rule exists in the first place.
I love that. And to make this really stick, we're going to build a little cinematic universe today for you. We have a recurring cast of fictional characters that are going to live inside all our examples.
I'm ready.
You're going to get to know them really well. First up, we have Frank the founder. So Frank is our majority shareholder, right? He's the ultimate corporate insider. He built the company, he holds a massive percentage of the stock, and he basically just thinks he owns the world.
We all know a Frank.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, we have Minority Mary. She represents the small retail investor.
Yeah.
She owns like a tiny fraction of a percent of the company
Yeah.
and is constantly fighting just to have a voice at the table against Frank's overwhelming power.
Totally. Then we also have employee Edgar. He's just the loyal worker bee. He doesn't have a lot of cash. He's honestly just trying to make sense of his stock options and hopefully get paid one day without the IRS entirely destroying his life.
Poor Edgar. And finally, we have Institution Igor. So Igor is the massive, heavyweight institutional whale. Think of like a multi-billion dollar hedge fund or a giant pension fund. Igor plays by a completely different set of rules simply because of his massive size.
Yeah, Igor throws his weight around. So we are going to put Frank, Mary, Edgar, and Igor through the ringer today to explain literally everything from voting rights to restricted stock to these crazy tax traps.
It's going to be a ride.
But before we even get to how they buy or sell, I want you, the listener, to pause and think about what it actually means to quote unquote own a stock. Like when you open an app and buy 10 shares of a tech company, what are you actually buying?
That is the big question.
Right. Do you just own a flickering green or red price ticker on a screen, or do you own a piece of a living, breathing legal entity? Take a second to think about that.
Because it really is the most fundamental question of this entire exam. When you buy a share of common stock, you are not just placing a bet on a casino table hoping some random number goes up.
Yeah.
You are acquiring literal property rights. You are acquiring a measure of control, a claim on real-world assets, and a highly specific place in a very strict corporate hierarchy.
So let's build that foundation right now. What does holding a piece of equity actually entitle you to on a totally base level? I mean, the most obvious one is voting rights,
But at
right?
the simplest level, if you own common stock, you get one vote per share.
Okay, easy enough.
Yeah. You get to vote on major corporate events, so electing the board of directors, approving mergers, or authorizing stock splits. But here's the thing. The Series 66 exam doesn't just want you to know that you can vote.
Of course not. That'd be too easy.
Exactly. It demands that you know exactly how those votes are mathematically counted.
Because the math is what dictates who actually holds the power in the boardroom.
Precisely. So the exam is going to heavily test your understanding of two completely distinct voting methods. You have statutory voting, which is also commonly referred to as straight voting, and then you have cumulative voting.
Okay, statutory and cumulative.
Right. And they sound somewhat similar on paper, maybe, but they produce wildly different outcomes for our characters.
Yeah. So let's put you in the shoes of Minority Mary to really feel the difference here. Mm. Imagine statutory voting, straight voting, like a local school board election.
Right.
Where the town is divided into, say, five separate geographic districts, and there is one open seat for each district.
Okay, I'm tracking.
So when you go to the ballot box, you are forced to cast a separate vote for District 1, a separate vote for District 2, and so on. You cannot take your vote for District 1 and somehow slide it over to District 2. You are locked into these separate individual races.
Got it. So let's actually run the math on that for the exam. Let's say the company is electing five board members. Minority Mary owns 100 shares. Under statutory voting, Mary gets 100 votes for seat A, 100 votes for seat B, 100 for seat C, D, and E.
Right. She has to deploy them in those specific locked silos.
Exactly. But remember, Frank the founder. Frank owns 1,000 shares. Mm. So Frank steps up to the ballot box. He places his 1,000 votes on seat A. He places 1,000 on seat B. He puts 1,000 on CD. He puts 1,000 on C, D, and E.
Ouch.
Yeah. When the dust settles, Frank wins every single individual race by a massive landslide of 1,000 to 100. Frank elects his best friend to seat A, his golf buddy to seat B, his lawyer to seat C.
And Minority Mary gets completely shut out. She owns a piece of the company, but she has absolutely zero representation on the board. Frank is just running the whole show.
Which is exactly why statutory voting heavily, heavily favors the majority shareholder. It essentially guarantees that whoever owns the most shares dictates 100% of the board.
It's brutal. But then we have the alternative, which is cumulative voting. And this completely changes the mathematics of corporate control.
It really does.
So under cumulative voting, we abandon the separate districts. Instead, imagine you are handed a giant bucket of tokens. The system takes the number of shares you own and multiplies it by the number of open board seats, creating just one giant cumulative pool of votes.
The big bucket of power.
Exactly. And you can take those tokens and dump them into any candidate's jar you want in whatever proportion you want.
So let's look at Mary's math now. She has 100 shares, and there are five open seats. Mm. 100 times 5 equals 500 total votes. Under cumulative voting, Mary does not have to spread those out at all.
Right. She can look at the board and say, look, I know Frank is going to dominate seats A, B, C, and D. I don't even care about those seats. I am taking all 500 of my votes, and I'm going all in on one single candidate for seat E.
Boom. So she dumps all 500 tokens into CD's jar. Frank, meanwhile, he has 1,000 shares times 5 seats, so he has 5,000 votes total. But Frank wants to control the whole board. He's greedy.
Naturally.
So he has to spread his 5,000 votes across all 5 seats to try and win them all. If he divides them equally, he's putting 1,000 votes on each seat.
Wait, let's think about this.
Yeah, here's the magic of cumulative voting. Mm. If Frank puts 1,000 on seat A, 1,000 on B, 1,000 on C, 1,000 on D, well, what about CD? If he puts 1,000 on E, he still beats her 500.
Right, but what if he miscalculates? Or what if Mary bands together with another minority shareholder?
Exactly. Or let's say Frank tries to get slightly strategic and spreads them out unevenly. Maybe he puts 1,500 on a couple seats because he's worried. Regardless of how Frank slices his 5,000 votes, because Mary concentrated her entire 500-vote bankroll on one seat, she has a mathematical probability of overwhelming Frank's divided attention on at least that one specific seat, especially if Frank spreads himself too thin.
Okay, this is a massive exam trap flag, like a huge one. You need to instantly recognize this relationship when you see the question. Cumulative voting protects the minority shareholder.
Yes.
By allowing Mary to pool her votes, cumulative voting gives her basically a mathematical battering ram to secure at least one seat on the board, ensuring the minority voice is actually heard in the boardroom.
So write this down. If you see statutory, think majority power. If you see cumulative, think minority protection. That is a guaranteed point on the Series 66.
Guaranteed. Okay. So Mary has her hard-fought board seat, but she has another major problem to worry about. Dilution.
Oh, dilution is a killer.
Right. So let's talk about preemptive rights, which are sometimes called anti-dilution rights. This is basically the right of a current shareholder to buy newly issued shares of the company before they are offered to the general public.
And to understand why preemptive rights are so crucial, you have to truly visualize what dilution does. Imagine you own 10% of a company that currently has 1 million shares outstanding.
Okay, so you own 100,000 shares.
Right. Your 10% gives you a certain amount of voting power, and it gives you a 10% claim on the company's earnings.
Sounds great.
But then Frank, the founder, decides the company needs cash to build a massive new factory. He goes to the board and says, hey, let's authorize and issue 1 million brand new shares, and sell them to the public to raise cash.
Okay, so if the company does that, there are now 2 million shares outstanding total. If you are minority, Mary, and you just sit there and do nothing, you still own your original 100,000 shares. But 100,000 divided by the new total of 2 million means you now only own 5% of the company. Your voting power was literally just cut in half. Your claim on earnings was just cut in half. You have been diluted.
It hurts. So preemptive rights give Mary a shield against this. Before Frank can sell those new 1 million shares to Wall Street, he actually has to knock on Mary's door and say, "Hey, you currently own 10% of the company. We're issuing 1 million new shares. You have the right, the preemptive right, to buy 10% of this new batch."
Which would be 100,000 new shares.
Right, before anyone else can touch them. And if Mary exercises that right and buys them,
mm-hmm.
she maintains her exact 10% proportional ownership.
It protects both her voting power and her ownership percentage. But, and this is why I love this show, I want to throw a scenario at you, the listener. Think about this carefully.
Here we go.
Frank's company is wildly successful. He decides to issue those 1 million new shares. Does minority Mary automatically, by default, get to buy her 10% cut first just because she is a common stockholder?
Yeah.
Take a beat. What do you think?
I feel like a lot of people would assume, yes, you know, it's her property. She should automatically get to protect it.
Yeah, it makes logical sense.
But that assumption will cost you dearly on the exam. The answer is absolutely not. Exam trap right here. Preemptive rights are not an automatic, universal, built-in right of common stock.
Oh.
Yeah, they must be explicitly written into the corporation's foundational charter. If the corporate charter doesn't specifically grant preemptive rights, Mary gets diluted, plain and simple. She has no automatic, inherent right to maintain her 10%.
That is such a brutal reality check. Like, you have to read the actual paperwork.
I always read the paperwork.
Always. Okay, so speaking of brutal reality checks, let's look at the absolute dark side of equity ownership.
Mm-hmm.
The doomsday scenario.
Oh boy.
Yeah. What happens if Frank, the founder, makes a massive strategic error, the company goes completely bankrupt, gets liquidated, and every single asset, the factories, the patents, the office chairs, is just sold off for scrap? Who gets the money from that scrap pile?
Well, there is a very strict legal hierarchy in a corporate liquidation. It's a definitive order of operations that the bankruptcy courts follow flawlessly.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely must memorize this order.
I always picture this like a buffet line at a completely disastrous corporate retreat, right? Where they didn't order nearly enough food. Who gets to eat first?
That's a great visual. Okay, at the very front of the line are the secured creditors. These are the major lenders, the banks, whose debt is backed by specific hard collateral.
So, like, if Bank of America holds the physical mortgage on Frank's factory building, they are secured.
Exactly. When the factory is sold, that money goes straight to them first.
They are carving up the prime rib. They get the best cuts, no questions asked.
Next in line, second priority, are the unsecured creditors. So these are general obligations.
Yeah.
This includes the vendors who shipped Frank cardboard boxes and haven't been paid yet.
Mm-hmm.
It includes unpaid wages owed to employee Edgar. It includes taxes owed to the IRS.
Okay, so they don't have a specific claim on a building, but they have a legally binding invoice.
Right.
So they are stepping up to the buffet, grabbing the chicken and the pasta. There's still decent food left for them. Who is third?
Third are the bondholders, specifically subordinated debt holders. These are the investors who bought the standard corporate bonds Frank issued like a few years ago.
Okay, so they get the salad and the weird side dishes. It's not great, but it's sustenance. Fourth in line.
Fourth is preferred stock. Now, we haven't talked much about preferred stock yet, but it's exactly what it sounds like. It is an equity position, but it has preference over common stock in two highly specific areas: dividend payouts and liquidation priority.
Got it.
So if there's literally any money left after the banks, the vendors, the IRS, and the bondholders are paid, which is rare, the preferred stockholders get their original investment back.
They are basically scraping the very bottom of the chafing dishes for rice. Which brings us to the common stockholders. Frank, Mary, Edgar, if he exercises options, where are they in the buffet line?
So you're standing outside in the parking lot. In corporate liquidation, common stockholders are dead last.
In the parking lot. Wow.
And I need to plant another massive exam trap flag right here. Because they are last in line, the most likely outcome in a true corporate bankruptcy is that the common stockholders receive absolutely nothing. Zero. The higher priority claims, the banks, the vendors, the bondholders, usually exhaust the scrap assets long before a single penny trickles down to the common equity.
Let's use a real-world example here to make it super tangible. Think about when a massive retail giant like, I don't know, Toys R Us or Enron goes under. The secured creditors get the value of the physical real estate. The unsecured creditors might get a few cents on the dollar for the unpaid inventory sitting in some warehouses.
Yeah.
By the time the bankruptcy lawyers finish billing their massive hours, there is literally a negative balance sheet. The common stock goes to zero. It is completely wiped off the face of the earth.
Exactly. The equity is entirely extinguished.
Which naturally makes me want to push back on this whole concept. Like, if I'm Minority Mary's, why in the world would I ever buy common stock if I am mathematically guaranteed to be the biggest loser in a bankruptcy?
That's a fair question.
I am taking on all this risk just to be thrown in the parking lot when things go south. Why not just buy the bonds and be way safer?
Because of the foundational trade-off of capitalism, it is the ultimate balance of risk and reward.
Yeah.
Yes, bondholders have a much safer position in liquidation, but their upside is strictly legally capped.
Right.
If you own a bond paying 5% interest, you only ever get your 5% interest and your principal back. Even if Frank the Founder's company cures a major disease, invents cold fusion, and quadruples in value overnight, the bondholder still only gets 5%.
But the common stock?
The common stock's upside is theoretically infinite. If the company's valuation goes from $10 million to $10 billion, the common stockholders capture all of that exponential growth. You take the highest risk in liquidation, the risk of total loss, in exchange for unlimited growth potential. You accept the absolute worst-case scenario specifically to gain access to the infinite best-case scenario.
Unlimited upside. That is exactly why Frank the Founder took the risk in his garage in the first place. Okay, so let's shift gears completely. Let's say the company didn't go bankrupt. The complete opposite happened.
Love a happy ending.
Frank's company is absolutely crushing it. The stock is up 500%. Frank is looking at his portfolio. He's a multimillionaire on paper. And he says, you know what? I'm tired. I want to buy a yacht.
As one does.
As one does. So he opens his brokerage account, types in an order to sell 5 million shares, and moves his mouse over the execute trade button. Can you just click sell?
Absolutely not. Do not pass go.
Buzzer sound in my head. Not happening.
Exactly. This brings us to one of the most heavily tested and frankly most misunderstood areas of the Series 66. The resale roadblocks.
Because the SEC does not just let anyone sell any stock at any time. There's a massive invisible fence around certain types of shares designed primarily to protect the totally oblivious retail public from getting rug pulled by insiders.
Right, so let's define the absolute core term here. Restricted stock. What exactly is it? Very simply, restricted stock is stock that has never been registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Okay, but how does someone even get unregistered stock? Because if I go on my phone right now and buy shares of Apple or Microsoft, those are registered, right?
Correct. The shares trading on the New York Stock Exchange are fully registered. But remember how Frank started his company? He started it in a messy garage. When he needed his first $100,000, he didn't do a massive public IPO on Wall Street.
No, he went to a few wealthy angel investors in his hometown.
Exactly. He sold them shares through a private placement, like a Regulation D offering. He also gave out shares to employee Edgar as compensation to keep him around when they couldn't afford to pay him a real salary. None of those early private shares were ever registered with the SEC.
And the fact that they aren't registered is the entire crux of the issue. To understand the why here, we have to go back to 1933. After the massive stock market crash of 1929, the government realized that companies were selling completely worthless paper to the public while just totally lying about their financials.
Yeah, it was bad.
So they created the SEC. And the SEC's entire philosophy is sunlight. Disclosure.
Sunlight is the best disinfectant. The SEC's primary mandate is that before a company can sell its stock to the general public, it must open its books. The registration process forces a company to disclose its audited financials, its risk factors, the backgrounds of its executives, its entire business plan.
Mm-hmm.
The SEC wants retail investors to have all the facts before they risk their retirement money.
So if Frank and his early investors completely bypass that rigorous registration process by acquiring their shares privately, the SEC is absolutely not going to let them turn around the very next day, dump those completely opaque, unregistered shares onto the public markets, and walk away with cold hard cash.
Which is why the SEC slaps those shares with a mandatory holding period. If you hold restricted stock, you're effectively in stock jail. You cannot sell it to the public. But the length of your sentence in stock jail depends entirely on the transparency of the company you hold stock in.
And there are two timeframes you must memorize for the exam. It is a 6-month holding period for SEC reporting companies and a 12-month holding period for non-reporting companies.
Right, so let's unpack the mechanics of why that difference actually exists. What is an SEC reporting company? It means the company is already public, they already have registered shares trading, and they are legally required to file continuous paperwork with the SEC.
Let's ELI 5 explain. Like, I'm half a sigh of those documents quickly because they pop up constantly on the test.
Sure. A reporting company files a 10K, which is their massive audited annual financial report. They file a 10Q, which is the quarterly unaudited update, and they file an 8K anytime a major material event happens, like the CEO resigning or a massive lawsuit being filed.
Got it. So because that company is constantly pumping current, accurate public information into the market ecosystem, the market has a very clear picture of what the company is actually worth. Therefore, if you hold restricted private shares of that specific company, the SEC only makes you hold them for 6 months.
Because the market already kind of knows what's going on. But contrast that with a non-reporting company, a completely private entity. That company is a total black box. They don't file 10Ks. They don't file 10Qs. The public knows absolutely nothing about their revenue, their debts, or their leadership.
Yeah, it's a mystery.
Because of that massive information asymmetry, the SEC forces a longer 12-month seasoning period. They want to give the market a full year to observe the company and figure out its true value before those unregistered shares can start floating around the retail ecosystem.
Makes total sense. All right, let's bring Frank, the founder, back. So Frank holds restricted stock in his own company, which is an SEC reporting company. He waits his 6 months. He literally marks the calendar. The day finally arrives. He's done his time in stock jail. Can he sell all his millions of shares now?
No. Because Frank is not just a regular guy who holds restricted stock. Frank is an affiliate.
Ah, okay. This is a massive distinction. An affiliate, which the SEC also calls a control person, is an insider. It is an officer, a director, or any shareholder who owns 10% or more of the company's outstanding voting stock.
And Frank is the CEO, and he owns 40% of the company. Frank is the ultimate affiliate.
Right.
And the SEC views affiliates as inherently dangerous to the stability of the public markets. Why? Because they literally control the company. They know if the upcoming earnings report is going to be a total disaster before anyone else does. And crucially, they own massive market-moving blocks of stock.
Like, if Frank panicked on a random Tuesday and dumped his entire 40% stake onto the market all at once, the sudden tidal wave of supply would instantaneously crash the stock price to zero, basically destroying the life savings of every retail investor holding the stock.
Exactly. To prevent that exact catastrophic scenario, the SEC imposes strict volume limits on affiliates. It restricts how much stock they can sell at any given time, filtering their shares into the market like a slow drip rather than a fire hose. This is governed by Rule 144.
Okay, let's do the math on Rule 144 because you will absolutely have to calculate this on the exam. The rule states that in any rolling 3-month window, an affiliate can only sell the greater of two specific numbers.
Let's break down those two numbers. Number one, 1% of the total outstanding shares of the same class of stock.
Okay, so if Frank's company has 20 million shares outstanding in total across the whole market, 1% of that is 200,000 shares. So number one is 200,000.
Exactly. Now let's calculate number two. The average weekly trading volume of the stock over the prior 4 weeks leading up to the sale.
So we look at the last 4 weeks of trading data. Let's say week one traded 120,000 shares. Week two was 140,000. Week three was 160,000. Week four was 180,000. You add those up and divide by four. The average weekly trading volume over the last 4 weeks is 150,000 shares. So number two is 150,000.
Perfect. Now here is the massive exam trap flag. Listen closely. The limit is the greater of those two numbers, not the lesser of.
Oh man, they love to test this.
They really do. The exam will give you a scenario exactly like the one we just walked through. They will give you the 1% number, which was 200,000, and the 4-week average number, which was 150,000, and they will ask you what Frank's maximum permitted sale is.
And human instinct is to assume regulators want to restrict you as much as possible, right? So people always accidentally pick the lower number.
Right.
Do not do that. The SEC allows the greater amount. So Frank is allowed to sell 200,000 shares, and he can only do that once every 3 months.
And here is the second part of that affiliate trap. Affiliates never escape these volume limits. It does not matter how long they hold the stock. Frank could hold his shares for 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. As long as he remains an affiliate, an officer, director, or 10% owner, he is permanently shackled by those volume limits. He can never just dump his entire position at once.
So Frank is on the slow drip forever. But let's look at Minority Mary. If you are Minority Mary, let's say you bought some restricted private shares from Frank early on. You own 0.1% of the company. You are not on the board. You are a non-affiliate.
This is a completely different ballgame.
So let's test this. If you are Minority Mary, it has been exactly 7 months. You want to sell your restricted shares in Frank's reporting company. Are you trapped by those same complex volume limits? Do you have to sit there and calculate 1% versus the four-week average?
The answer is no. Mary can sell them all at once. Non-affiliates completely lose the volume limits after the mandatory holding period is up. Frank, because he is an insider, is trapped by volume limits forever. Mary, because she is just a regular investor with no inside control, is freed from the volume limits after 6 months.
She does her 6 months in stock jail, she steps out, and she can liquidate her entire position on day one. Now, just to be incredibly precise for the hardest possible exam question, Mary's issuer must still have current public info available between month 6 and month 12. She technically needs a full 12 months to pass before she can sell with zero conditions whatsoever, but the volume limits, those evaporate at month 6 for her.
It's a great nuance. And before we move off Rule 144, we must mention the warning flare, Form 144.
Right. When Frank finally decides to sell his allowed 200,000 shares, he can't just do it secretly in the dark. If an affiliate is selling more than 5,000 shares, or if the total dollar amount of the sale is greater than $50,000 in a 90-day period, they must formally file Form 144 with the SEC.
And the timing on that is critical. Form 144 must be filed concurrently with the placement of the sell order. The exact moment Frank tells his broker to hit sell, that form must be filed. It acts as a public warning flare to the rest of the market, signaling, hey, an insider's cashing out some chips. You might want to pay attention.
But what if you aren't Frank and you aren't Mary? What if you are Institution Igor? Igor manages a colossal hedge fund. He doesn't have time to wait 6 months for a seasoning period. He moves hundreds of millions of dollars a day. How does the SEC handle the massive whales?
They give them their own VIP club with entirely different rules. This is called the QIB Resale Safe Harbor under SEC Rule 144A.
I love visualizing this rule because it feels so incredibly exclusive. Imagine the secondary market for unregistered stock is an elite underground nightclub. I am the VIP bouncer working the door. Right, I've got the clipboard. Frank the founder walks up wearing a nice suit and says he wants to sell his unregistered stock inside. I put my arm across the door and say, sorry, Frank, you're an affiliate. Get in the 6 month waiting line and you can only bring 1% of your shares inside. No cutting.
Frank is, of course, humiliated.
Then Institution Igor pulls up in a massive motorcade. Igor is a qualified institutional buyer, a QIB. To be a QIB, Igor must manage a portfolio with at least $100 million in unaffiliated securities. For broker-dealers, the threshold is slightly lower at $10 million, but for Igor the hedge fund, it's $100 million. Igor walks up to the door. I unhook the velvet rope, bow slightly, and say, step right in, Igor. No holding period required, no volume limits whatsoever. Have a great night.
It is exactly like that. The Rule 144A safe harbor allows for the immediate resale of restricted securities, but exclusively to other QIBs. There is no SEC registration required, and most importantly, there is absolutely no holding period.
But why? Like, if the SEC is so obsessed with protecting investors that they lock Mary up for 6 months, why do they let Igor trade unregistered stock on day one?
Because Igor doesn't need the SEC's protection. The SEC's logic is that if an institution is sophisticated enough to amass and manage $100 million in securities, they have absolute armies of lawyers, analysts, and accountants. They can demand to see a private company's books themselves. They can fend for themselves. They don't need the SEC to hold their hand and force a six-month seasoning period for the market to figure things out.
Okay, but here is the massive exam trap flag regarding Rule 144A. Do not confuse the standard restricted stock resale rule with the QIB safe harbor. The standard retail rule requires a 6 or 12 month holding period. The QIB safe harbor has no holding period. Igor can buy a massive block of restricted, unregistered stock on Monday morning and sell it to another $100 million QIB on Tuesday afternoon.
Rule 144A essentially creates a massive, highly liquid shadow secondary market for unregistered securities. But it is surrounded by a massive wall. Retail investors like Minority Mary can never, ever get inside.
Okay, let's zoom back out. Frank, the founder, is not a QIB. Frank is an affiliate. He is permanently trapped by those Rule 144 volume limits. He owns 40% of a billion-dollar company, but he can only sell a tiny sliver of it every 3 months. His wealth is almost entirely locked up on paper. So how does he actually buy his yacht? How does he extract cold, hard cash from the company without selling his shares?
He extracts cash directly from the company's treasury. This brings us to corporate profit distributions, better known as dividends.
dividends. They are how companies share their actual realized success with their owners in real time, rather than forcing the owners to wait until they sell the stock to realize a gain. But let's be clear up front, dividends are never guaranteed. The board of directors has total, absolute discretion over whether to declare a dividend. They can pay one every quarter for 10 years and then just suddenly stop without warning.
Exactly. But when a board does decide to distribute wealth, they generally do it in one of two ways, cash dividends or stock dividends. And the Series 66 wants you to know the profound tax differences between the two.
So let's look at cash first, because the IRS certainly cares about cash. Cash dividends are exactly what they sound like. The company literally wires cash into your brokerage account. And because real cash is hitting your pocket, it is a taxable event in the year you receive it. Depending on how long you've held the stock, it's either taxed at your higher ordinary income rate or a lower qualified dividend rate. But either way, the tax man is taking a cut immediately.
But then we have stock dividends. With a stock dividend, the company's treasury doesn't send you a single penny of cash. Instead, they just give you more shares of stock. If they declare a 10% stock dividend and you currently own 100 shares, they simply deposit 10 brand new shares into your account.
But here's the crucial question for the listener. Does the IRS tax those 10 new shares the exact moment they hit your account? Take a guess.
The answer is no. Stock dividends are not taxed when you receive them.
I always use the pizza slice analogy to explain the mechanics of why this isn't taxed. It's so good. Let's say you own a pizza. The pizza represents your total investment in the company. Right now, your pizza is cut into 8 large slices. The company declares a stock dividend. What they are actually doing is taking that exact same pizza you already own and just slicing it into 12 smaller slices.
You physically have more slices in your hand, you have more shares, but you do not have more total pizza. The overall size of the pie hasn't changed. The total value of your investment hasn't increased by a single cent.
So let's put real math to this because it's vital for the test. Let's say you bought 100 shares of Frank's company at $10 a share. Your total out-of-pocket investment, your total cost basis is $1,000.
Then the company declares a 10% stock dividend. You receive 10 new shares. You now own 110 shares. But your total investment value hasn't magically increased. Your total cost basis remains exactly $1,000.
So what changed? The cost basis per share. You take your $1,000 total basis and divide it by your new total of 110 shares. Your cost basis per share simply drops from $10 down to roughly $9.09. Because you haven't actually made any new money, there is no economic gain to be taxed.
And that is a massive exam trap flag. The exam will give you a scenario where an investor receives a stock dividend and will ask you what their immediate tax liability is. The answer is zero. You do not trigger a taxable event until you eventually sell those shares later on. All you do upon receipt is adjust your cost basis per share downward.
Okay, so we know how they are taxed. Now let's talk about the timeline of how cash dividends actually leave the company and get to your account. This timeline is heavily tested, and it is governed by 4 specific dates. I call them the DERP dates. DERP, Declaration Ex Dividend Record Payment.
The DERP acronym is perfect. Let's walk through the chronology. The first date is the declaration date. This is the day Frank's board of directors holds a meeting, bangs a gavel, and publicly announces, we are officially going to pay a 50-cent cash dividend.
Simple enough. Let's skip to the third date, the record date. The record date is the specific day you must legally be registered on the company's books as an owner in order to get the money. If Frank's company looks at the shareholder registry at 5:00 p.m. on the record date and your name is not on it, you don't get the 50 cents.
And the fourth date is the payment date. That's just the day the company actually wires the cash.
Now, I skipped the second date, the ex-dividend date, on purpose, because I want to push back on something here. Hold on. I'm looking at these 4 dates, D-E-R-P. I understand that the board of directors declares the dividend, so they clearly set the declaration date. They also determine when they want to look at the book, so they set the record date. And they decide when to mail the check, so they set the payment date. So logically, does the board just open a calendar and pick the ex-dividend date too?
And that is exactly what the exam wants you to assume. But the answer is no. The ex-dividend date is the one date not set by the board of directors. The ex-dividend date is set by the exchange where the stock trades, like the NYSE or NASDAQ.
Why? Why does the exchange get involved?
Because the ex-dividend date is entirely dependent on the settlement mechanics of the stock market. Ex-dividend literally translates to without dividend. It is the very first day that a stock trades without the buyer being entitled to receive the upcoming dividend.
So let's deep dive into the mechanics of this, specifically looking at the new T+1 settlement rules. T+1 means that when you click buy on your brokerage app, the trade actually takes one full business day to formally settle and clear the financial plumbing of Wall Street. You don't legally own the shares until the next day.
Causality is everything here. Let's say the board sets the record date for a Tuesday. That means to get the dividend, your name must be physically printed in the company's ledger by 5:00 p.m. on Tuesday.
So under T+1, if I log in and buy the stock on Monday, the trade takes one day to settle. It settles on Tuesday. My name goes on the book on Tuesday. I meet the deadline. I get the dividend.
Exactly. But what if you wait? What if you log in and buy the stock on Tuesday morning, the actual record date?
Under T+1, a trade executed on Tuesday doesn't settle until Wednesday.
And Wednesday is too late. The book's closed on Tuesday. Because your trade won't settle until Wednesday, the person who sold you the stock on Tuesday is still technically the owner on record. They get the dividend, not you. Therefore, Tuesday is the first day the stock is trading ex-dividend without the dividend attached for the buyer.
This is a critical mathematical reality you must memorize. Under T+1 settlement rules, the ex-dividend date falls on the exact same day as the record date.
Which leads to the most fascinating mechanical quirk in the entire stock market. What happens to the actual price of the stock on the morning of the ex-dividend date?
This is my absolute favorite part. On the morning of the ex-date, before the opening bell even rings, the exchange's computer systems automatically step in and manually drop the opening price of the stock by the exact mathematical amount of the dividend. If Frank's stock closed Monday at $50 and there is a 50-cent dividend when the market opens on Tuesday, the X date, the stock will open at $49.50.
And a lot of investors see this and panic, thinking the company lost value overnight. But why does the stock price drop by the exact dividend amount?
Think of it like going to a livestock auction and bidding on a pregnant cow. If you buy that cow before it gives birth, which represents buying the stock before the X date, you are going to pay a premium price. Why? Because you are fundamentally buying two animals. You are buying the cow, and you are getting the valuable calf that is about to be born. The calf is the dividend.
Right. It's priced into the cow's overall valuation.
But imagine you go to the auction the very next morning to buy that exact same cow. But overnight, the cow gave birth. The farmer who owned the cow yesterday gets to keep the newborn calf. Today, you are only buying the cow. Are you going to pay the exact same premium price you would have paid yesterday? Of course not. You demand a discount on the price of the cow because the value of the calf has literally left the cow.
It's a brilliant, visceral analogy. On the ex-dividend date, the cash designated for the dividend has legally been earmarked to leave the corporate treasury and go into the pockets of the previous day's shareholders. That cash is gone. The company's balance sheet is literally lighter by that exact amount. Therefore, the market perfectly adjusts the share price downward to reflect that the value has left the building.
All right, so cash dividends are fantastic for investors like Mary or Igor, but what if you work for Frank the founder's startup in the very early days? We haven't talked much about employee Edgar yet. Edgar is working 80-hour weeks. Frank's company is growing exponentially, but they are burning through capital. Frank doesn't have the cash flow to pay Edgar a massive salary, and he certainly isn't paying cash dividends yet.
So Frank pays Edgar in paper. He compensates him with employee stock options.
But the Series 66 doesn't just want you to know what an option is. It wants to know exactly which kind of option Frank gave Edgar, because the tax implications of that choice will drastically alter Edgar's life. Welcome to getting paid in paper.
There are two main types of employee stock options we need to compare, and they are treated entirely differently by the IRS. We have incentive stock options, commonly called ISOs, and we have non-qualified stock options, or NQSOs.
Let's start with ISOs, because they are incredibly restrictive, but heavily pitched as the tax-friendly dream for employees. First rule of ISOs, they are for employees only. Frank cannot give an ISO to his outside legal consultant or a graphic design contractor or an external board member. They are a special, exclusive perk reserved solely for actual W-2 employees like Edgar.
And on the surface, they look amazing for Edgar. When Frank grants the option to Edgar saying you have the right to buy 1,000 shares at $10 each someday, there is zero regular income tax owed. It's just a promise.
Okay, that makes sense. Edgar hasn't received anything tangible yet.
But then, 3 years later, the company is booming. The stock is trading on the open market at $100 a share. Edgar decides to exercise his ISOs. He pays his guaranteed $10 strike price, and he's suddenly holding shares with $100. He has $90 of built-in profit per share. Under regular IRS rules, does Edgar owe regular income tax at the moment of exercise?
No, that's the huge selling point of ISOs. No regular income tax at grant and no regular income tax at exercise. Edgar only pays tax when he finally sells the stock down the road.
Right, under regular tax rules. But this is where the exam will absolutely obliterate you if you aren't paying attention. We need to talk about the AMT trap. Warning, the AMT trap.
The alternative minimum tax. Walk me through the mechanics of this trap, because it destroys people in real life, not just on tests.
The AMT is essentially a shadow tax system. It was designed decades ago to ensure that extremely wealthy individuals couldn't use endless deductions and loopholes to pay zero taxes. It forces a parallel calculation of your income. And here's the trap. Even though the regular IRS code says Edgar's $90 per share profit at exercise isn't taxed yet, the AMT system classifies that $90 spread as an AMT preference item.
Wait, let me make sure I'm hearing this right. Edgar exercised 1,000 shares. The spread is $90 per share. That's $90,000 of profit. But Edgar hasn't sold the stock. He hasn't received a single dime of cash. All he did was buy the stock and hold it in his account. Are you telling me the AMT system forces him to pay real cash taxes on that phantom $90,000 paper gain?
Exactly. That $90,000 paper gain is added to Edgar's AMT income calculation for that year. If that pushes him over the AMT exemption threshold, Edgar will owe a massive real-world cash tax bill to the IRS in April, purely based on the theoretical value of stock he hasn't even sold yet.
He could literally be bankrupted by that. He has to write a $20,000 check to the IRS, but he doesn't have the cash because all his wealth is tied up in the shares. He is stock rich and cash poor.
It is a vicious, terrifying trap if you aren't prepared for it.
Okay, so let's say Edgar somehow survives the AMT trap. He pays the shadow tax out of his savings. His ultimate goal with an ISO is to hold the stock long enough so that when he finally does sell it, the entire gain is taxed at the much lower, highly favorable long-term capital gains rate rather than his high ordinary income tax rate. But to unlock that special capital gains rate, he has to navigate another maze, the statutory holding periods.
Yes. For ISOs to qualify for long-term capital gains, you must memorize the 2-1 rule.
Let's draw the timeline for them.
Edgar must satisfy two completely separate time clocks simultaneously. First, he must hold the shares for at least 2 years from the date the options were originally granted to him by Frank. Second, he must hold the actual shares for at least 1 year from the day he exercised the option and bought them.
2 years from grant, 1 year from exercise. A great memory aid here if you get flustered on the exam. The longer wait, the 2 years, always goes with the earlier event in the timeline, the grant date.
Exactly. Both clocks must expire before he can sell. If Edgar gets impatient, or if he gets squeezed by that AMT tax bill and is forced to sell the shares early just to generate cash, it triggers what the IRS calls a disqualifying disposition.
Which means he loses his golden ticket. If he sells early, all that special tax treatment vanishes, and that $90 spread is retroactively taxed as brutal ordinary income. So that is the ISO. Strict rules, limited to W-2 employees only, terrifying AMT traps, but the ultimate reward is lower capital gains rates. What about the other flavor? Non-qualified stock options or NQSOs?
NQSOs are the Wild West compared to ISOs. They are much broader. Frank can grant NQSOs to anyone, employees like Edgar, but also outside directors, independent contractors, or consultants.
And what about the tax traps?
There is no AMT trap with NQSOs, and there are no strict 2-1 holding periods you have to memorize to avoid disqualification. But there is a massive trade-off for that simplicity.
The tax bill comes due immediately, in broad daylight. With an NQSO, the absolute moment employee Edgar exercises the option and buys the stock, the regular IRS steps in. The spread between his $10 exercise price and the $100 market price, that $90 profit, is immediately taxed as ordinary income, right then and there.
Right. It is treated on his W-2 exactly as if Frank had handed Edgar a $90,000 cash bonus. Edgar owes ordinary income tax, plus payroll taxes like Social Security and Medicare, on that spread in the year of exercise, regardless of whether he sells the stock or holds it.
He pays the highest possible tax rate on the phantom gain immediately. Any further growth in the stock price after that exercise date will be treated as capital gains, but that initial massive spread is pure ordinary income.
So let's put you, the listener, in the driver's seat for an interactive exam question. We know ISOs are potentially better for the employee, assuming they avoid the AMT trap, because of the capital gains treatment. But think about this from Frank the founder's perspective.
Okay, yeah. So Frank is looking at his corporate balance sheet at the end of the year. His company made a massive amount of money, and he desperately wants a corporate tax deduction to offset those revenues. Should Frank structure his employee compensation plan using ISOs or NQSOs? What do you guys think?
He should absolutely, without question, issue NQSOs. This is the exact side-by-side comparison the Series 66 loves to test. NQSOs give the employer an immediate corporate tax deduction equal to the exact amount of ordinary income the employee is forced to recognize at exercise.
It's perfectly symmetrical. If Edgar is forced to recognize $90,000 of ordinary income on his personal tax return when he exercises his NQSO, Frank's company gets to claim a $90,000 tax deduction on the corporate tax return.
But what if Frank had given him ISOs?
Exam trap flag right here. ISOs give the employer zero tax deduction in a normal qualifying scenario. Because Edgar isn't recognizing regular ordinary income at exercise, Frank gets no corresponding deduction.
The only bizarre edge case where an employer gets a deduction with an ISO is if the employee messes up their 2-1 holding periods, triggers a disqualifying disposition, and is thereby forced to recognize ordinary income. Only then does the company get the deduction. But Frank can't rely on Edgar messing up. So if Frank wants guaranteed corporate tax breaks, he is issuing NQSOs all day long.
Edgar takes the brutal ordinary income tax hit, and Frank gets the corporate deduction. Classic Frank.
Yep, typical Frank.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of technical ground today. We started at the foundational mathematics of voting rights, walked through the doomsday of liquidation, navigated the invisible fences of restricted stock, broke down the mechanics of settlement and dividends, and ended with the tax traps of employee options. Let's lock this firmly into your short-term memory with a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways. You ready?
Let's do it. Pit me.
First up, statutory versus cumulative voting.
Cumulative voting equals minority protection. It is the token jar. It lets Minority Mary pull all her votes onto one candidate to secure a board seat against the majority.
Where do common stockholders stand in a corporate liquidation?
Dead last. They are in the parking lot behind the buffet line. Behind secured creditors, unsecured creditors, bondholders, and preferred stock. They will likely receive zero.
What are the Rule 144 volume limits for affiliates like Frank?
It is the greater of two numbers, 1% of outstanding shares, or the average weekly trading volume over the prior 4 weeks. And remember the trap. Affiliates never, ever escape these limits.
The QIB resale safe harbor under Rule 144A.
The VIP club. Qualified institutional buyers need $100 million in unaffiliated securities. The massive trap. There is no holding period required under the safe harbor.
The DERP dates for cash dividends.
A declaration ex-dividend record payment. The crucial takeaway is that the exchange sets the ex-dividend date, not the board of directors.
Yeah.
And under T+1 settlement rules, the ex-date falls on the exact same day as the record date. The stock price automatically drops on the ex-date.
And finally, employee stock options. ISOs versus NQSOs.
ISOs are for W-2 employees only. The employee must be aware of the AMT trap at exercise, and they must satisfy the 2-1 holding rule, 2 years from grant, 1 year from exercise to get capital gains. NQSOs, on the other hand, can go to anyone. They trigger brutal ordinary income tax immediately at exercise, but they give the employer a guaranteed tax deduction.
Incredible. We have mapped out the entire life cycle and mechanics of equity characteristics.
And you know, if we pull back and connect all these mechanics to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over before your exam. Think about the ultimate irony of equity ownership we've uncovered today. The founders, like Frank, and the common shareholders, like Mary, they are the ones who actually build the economy. They take the massive entrepreneurial leap. They fund the innovation.
They take all the risk up front.
Yet the legal rules of the market we just studied are designed to punish that exact risk. The liquidation rules place them at the absolute back of the line in bankruptcy, guaranteeing they lose everything. And if they succeed, the SEC traps them with severe volume restrictions and holding periods, making it incredibly difficult to actually sell their successful creation.
It's crazy when you frame it like that.
The financial system intentionally forces the captain to go down with the ship while ensuring the creditors and the massive institutions walk away with lifeboats. It is a brutal, beautifully complex system. Good luck in your Series 66. And keep diving deep.